Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Jesse David Fox. You know, each episode, I actually ask the guests what joke they would like to talk about. And I tell them it could be a recent bit from their most recent special that they're really proud of. But sometimes they pick an early breakthrough. What I like about the latter option is sometimes the joke leads the way. Like, it's so good and so much better than the rest of their act that it sort of acts as a sort of guide for the comic's career. And that's what we have this week with Cristela Alonso, whose second special, Middle Classy, a follow-up to Lower Classy, premiered on Netflix earlier this week. We'll be playing the version of the joke, Hello Es Nasa, from her 2014 album, Some of the Hits, but as you'll see in the interview, the joke stems from long, long before then. So, here is Cristela Alonso.
Guys ever lied so much on a resume, you're actually shocked that they give you the job? Like, you lie so much, you want to have a talk with the company to make sure they're not messing with you, you know? Like, hey, psst, come here. You sure about this? Look at me, look at my resume. Do I look like an astronaut? Because I'm like, when I lie, I go all the way. I'm not going to do that whole, hey, I type 80 words a minute. I'm like, fuck it, I went to the moon. And I do that because my sister is my fake boss for every fake job I've ever had. So when you're calling to check references, you're never calling a real company. You're calling my sister's house. You always know it's crap because she's this 40-year-old Mexican mother of three, so every time she answers the phone, she's like, hello? Is NASA? I don't know. Yes, with the shuttles and the rockets, yes, yes, yes. Said he'll get off the bed. She's the best astronaut we've got, yeah. She goes to the moon like 5 times a week. It's crazy. Sergio, get off the stupid bed right now. Oh, no, 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 I'm not busy. No, no, no. No, I'm in the middle of a countdown. And then 10, 9, 8. I hate working, and I realize why. It's because when you're a kid, nobody tells you that when you grow up, you're going to have to work every day of your life. No one tells you that. When I was a kid, I couldn't wait to grow up and be an adult. Now that I'm an adult, I can't wait to fucking die. Sometimes life just sucks. Come on, am I ever going to pay off my Montgomery Ward's credit card? No. That store hasn't been around for 10 years. I still owe them for a VCR and a pair of LA gear I don't have anymore. You fucking with me. I'm just glad bill collectors are not on Facebook yet. Oh, some of you got scared. That's the last thing I need to get a friend request from Visa. comment on everything I do. Hey, today's payday. Visa likes this.
I am here with Cristela Alonso. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I was realizing when I was listening to this joke that I picture your sister from your TV show. Like, I'm like, oh, it's the same person. But I realized a nice place to start is, who is your actual sister? Can you, what was your relationship with her like growing up and as you get older? So just so the audience could sort of picture who you're talking about here.
So my sister's, you know, she hates when I say this, but she's 11 years older than I am. And growing up in like a first generation household, my mom was working all the time. So my sister really helped raise me for the first part of my life. So we have a very close, very sisterly relationship that's almost a little bit motherly, which I think is actually very typical in a lot of the Latino households that I grew up in, where, you know, it's the relationships, the roles aren't defined. You're a little bit of everything, right? But I think that's true in a lot of close families anyway. So my sister and I, she has three children. And when I was in sixth grade, I started taking care of them on my summers, you know, off of school. And eventually I ended up helping raise my nephews and my niece because my sister and her husband were working and childcare was expensive. And, you know, so I moved in with them. And that was actually the premise of my show. It was a real time of my life where I kind of just stayed there and helped raise my niece, my nephews. And, you know, and my mom moved in because she was getting on in age and she ended up passing away. Like, I was the caregiver of everybody. Mm-hmm. So the 11-year gap when you're a child is so, it's just so big because, you know, kids at school are singing like the Itsy Bitsy Spider and I'm like singing Hard Habit to Break Chicago because she's going through a breakup. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, the experience is different. But she was always my fake boss for every fake job I've ever had. She's always had my back. You know what I mean? So it's like that thing where, look, you don't need to have experience if you can make it up, you know? So that's kind of where we go.
So, yeah. So as you get into it, explain the real history before we get to even with the joke or even before you're maybe a comedian. Like, what was actually happening? Are there specific examples of what you did? Like, what did this actually look like?
So my mom passed away in 2002. I was living in Dallas with my sister, and I realized I was kind of stuck. At this point, I wasn't even thinking of stand-up. I didn't even think of stand-up as a job, but I needed some work. I needed money coming in. So I remember I applied. I was a server. You know, I was an actor. I was doing theater before I moved to Dallas. So serving was really one of my go-to jobs. So I applied for this Italian restaurant that was opening up nearby. And then I had another job that I saw, and it was a Help Wanted ad. And it just said office help. And I had never worked in an office. So I just randomly, I mean, a Help Wanted ad in a newspaper. This is how I found it. And I showed up and it was a comedy club. Now, I loved comedy, but I didn't know that it was a job. So I went in, I asked for an application, and I lied and said I could do all of this stuff. I lied and said I was so good at all of these programs and everything, like just insane. And I instantly put my sister's name because she was married. She had a different last name. So I lied and said that I was her assistant at her job at that point. And I told her, hey, Julie, if this company calls, tell them that I'm like the best assistant and that you hate to see me leave, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, I got you all day, every day. So I got the job.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, so I had to answer phones. I had to create the marketing stuff for all these comics that were coming, the calendars and everything. And I didn't know what to do. I had to answer phones for the ticket sales. And the first comic that I had to work the weekend for was Mitch Hedberg.
Wow.
And Mitch Hedberg sold out so quick that I was just slammed with all these phone calls. And I'm like, oh my God, I've never worked a phone with so many lines. Like, you know, it was just one of those things where I'm like, oh my God. I went to like an Office Depot and I bought like this printing software that, like, you know, the kind that moms buy to make calendars and like everything. I bought that software. I learned how to make calendars out of that software over a weekend, and I kind of got through everything. And the longer I stayed at the comedy club, comics would come by, and they would tell me that I was funny. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that everyone in my family was funny. That's the thing. It's like the people I grew up with, and I don't know if it's specifically like a Latino thing, but in my neighborhood, people were hilarious. We would die just laughing at dumb stuff. And I started doing stand-up. Wanda Sykes came in. She was headlining, and she had Keith Robeson with him, who he won't remember this, but he told me, you're going to end up doing stand-up, and you're going to do well. And I was like, get out of here. And then months later, I thought, you know what? Let's do it. Let's try it, right? And I remember at that point, I had moved in with my brother, and I sat down one day, and I started writing a joke. And I was like, let's be specific.
Wait, so I want to make sure I know where we are in this timeline, because I feel like you've now come through. So you started doing, you said, let's try doing stand-up.
Yes.
And is the joke you're talking about, when you're like, let's try doing stand-up, what is a joke? We're talking about your first time ever doing stand-up?
So like, I didn't know what to talk about. I took a stand-up class at the Dallas Club, because that was the only way that I could get on stage at that club, because I was the office person. I wasn't a real comic. And this local comic, Dean Lewis, taught the class, and I had a graduation show. I did the show, and then I thought, I love this. Mm-hmm. Now I gotta write stuff, you know? And I noticed that comics would do a lot of the same topics. And then they would get mad at each other because they're like, you stole my joke. You took my joke. And I'm like, we're talking about the most mundane thing. Like, it's so possible to cover it.
Yeah.
So one day I decided I'm going to try to write a joke that's very specific to me. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I literally was sitting down in my little notebook, like my little black and white composition book. And I'm like, what's specific? What do I do that's specific?
Yeah.
And I looked over at the printing software that I bought at Office Depot, and I'm like, I lie on resumes. You know, like, I'm sure I'm not the only one. Yeah. And I just started doing it, and I started building it out from that.
Yeah.
And that ended up being one of like the first big joke that people knew me for.
So that's fascinating. So I want to ask about specific parts of that story, because it's like, this is so clearly, this builds through, you know, your first Conan set that's in there. So, like, this truly is, like, the joke that is there from the beginning. And it's interesting when certain jokes for comedians can be, like, their sidekicks in their journeys. Like, okay, I have this joke, and nothing else is good, but I have this one, and they're telling me which direction to go in. But, so, you're a fan of comedy beforehand. Had you been to a comedy club beforehand?
I had. Now, I had gone to college in St. Louis for, like, a year, and Dave Chappelle was playing, I want to say it was the Funny Bone or something. And it was right after like Half Baked, but I was already a fan of Chappelle, and I went to see him. And again, that was the first time I had been in a club. I didn't know that comedy clubs existed, you know, because all the comedy that I saw was on TV, you know? So it was just kind of like, oh, this is what you do on TV. But I remember again, thanks to the trusty old school newspaper, I saw a picture of him, and I'm like, oh my God, that's the guy. Like, that's Dave Chappelle. I went to see him, and I thought it was kind of like, it was like going to a concert, right? Yeah. Where you go, but you know, it's like you go to a concert. Like I go see Billy Joel, but I don't think like, hey man, let's learn the piano. You know what I mean? So like, let's just learn the piano and let's become Billy Joel, you know? So that was the only time I had gone prior to getting the job.
So it must be like you're working there. You're like, oh, comedians are kind of people. I'm able to have conversations with them. I guess there's no big difference. So you take the class, and if this joke wasn't in your first set, what were you doing the first time you did stand up as a contrast, right? It's like, what even is that then when you're like, okay, time to do this thing I've never done before?
So I actually have my first set. Like I have it online, and it's private. And my the first time I ever went up was Labor Day 2003, I think. And every Labor Day or whatever, I on my anniversary, I make it public so people can watch my first set. And I remember, like, I do a joke about the game of life, the board game, and how, like, it's so not life at all. Like, it, you just succeed so much in that board game that even the failures, you're like, I would love to fail at this, you know? So I did my own version of the, like, game of life where it's like, you got a new car, move 2 spaces. Oh, you got a DUI, move back 3 spaces. You know, it's like that was one of my first jokes that I wrote. I also did a joke about, like, Walmart greeters. Because, like, the commercials always showed the greeters so happy to see you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go to Walmarts in real life and they could care less. They're like, why are you here? Like, you know, so I did that. And, I mean, it was just my first stuff was really, like, I would do that game of life joke now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I probably will, actually, now that I remember it. <You know? laughs> I had that, but I used to do silly stuff. Like, yeah. I used to do a joke about how vampires are always very artistic. Like, they're always into art. They have play piano and stuff. And you never just see a plumber vampire, like a blue-collar vampire that's just like, oh, I want to suck your blood and fix your pipes. Like, you know what I mean? So that's a lot of my stuff at the beginning.
Was this your first joke you wrote about your family?
Wow, yes. That was the very first joke I wrote about my family. I just realized that. Wow.
Did you have any, you know, like, I assume at the beginning, you don't think like, well, one day I'll be interviewed by this or one day I'm going to be famous. So you don't think, who cares about writing a joke about my family? It doesn't matter. But like, were there concerns? Do you have family that'd be like, how dare you talk about me? Like, are you just like, who cares? It's a hobby. You're just like, I'm just going to do it.
You know, I think that my family, for the longest time, couldn't understand what stand-up was.
Mm.
That they were fine with it. Because I think my family couldn't understand that anybody would go see me. You know, because I'm the youngest of four, you know. Like, you can be successful, you can do whatever, but, like, you're always going to be that same kid to your family. And I remember it wasn't till maybe 5 years into it that they saw a show. They were backstage at a show in Dallas, and they saw the crowd. And I want to say that one of my brothers was like, why are they here? like, it was so weird. And I'm like, well, because I'm doing a show. They're like, they're here for you? Like, it was just so, like, they couldn't understand it. And at that point, I had already talked about them, you know? So, like, and the thing is, everything I say is true. Mm-hmm. So they can't get upset at it because everything I say is true.
It's so funny because it does make sense because you're like, comedy by nature, you know, there's that sort of conversational element. So they're just like, oh, Cristela's being Cristela. She's just doing her thing. And then you don't realize, like, it's somewhere along the way you're working on this on purpose and that an audience is, like, interested in it. And now they're characters in a world, regardless, even before the TV show, but, like, they're like, oh, now people are come to hurt you as, like, the depository of their entire history.
It's really insane, especially, you know, on a very honest note, my family grew up in extreme poverty, and we were always kind of overlooked, or if we weren't overlooked, we were made fun of for being the poor people, you know, so we were very used to mentally, I think, to be, we were conditioned to think that what we did wasn't very special, you know? So it was like this thing, my family was all about survival. So anything that we did, I don't think that there was really a chance that we ever thought that what we could do could actually be noticed and be kind of considered different or special. Yeah. So it was one of those things where my family, it really took them a long time. And I think at times right now, like they still don't react the way that I think, you know, you would want the family to react. Like, when I told them that I got a second Netflix special, they're like, oh, cool. Like, okay. Like, okay. Like, you know what I mean? Like, okay. Like, that's what we're doing. Okay. Okay. Like, you know, like I told them I got a new tire for my car. Like, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like, you know, when we think of observational comedy, or like observation in comedy, we think of like, oh, have you ever noticed airplanes or blah, blah, blah. But like, there is something about observing lives that are unobserved. And one, what does that mean to the people that are observed who are not used to it or not even thinking of it? And what it means to be able to do that. And like, I wonder what it is. I think thinking about it as you were so much younger than your family, being in a position where you were put in a position where you were observing how people were behaving. Like there is like almost like when you tell stories of your family, it's like the view of a child seeing people doing things. Does that resonate?
Yeah. But also, you know, it's funny, you know, what I learned that really worked for me, and by working for me means that it just felt natural, was that the more specific I was, that's the secret that I think to stand up that a lot of people don't understand. And it's not for everybody, but for me, it's like the more specific you are, the more universal it can be.
Yeah.
You know, because what I started learning, and it came from, you know, from the joke, the resume joke, is that the more I thought about these specific parts of my life, the more they kind of resonated. And I remember like, and I just sit down sometimes. First of all, I record every set I do. Doesn't matter where I'm at, open mic, theater, club, all of them. I have been doing that since day one.
Wow.
And I have been doing that because I love the evolution of a joke. You know, there's something, I'm a big Beatles fan. And like, I remember the first time I heard, it was like 22 tracks of the Beatles and the evolution of Strawberry Fields. And you hear like the first, you know, like the first run to the finished product, and you see that evolution. And that's what I love about writing jokes. You see that evolution. So I record every set, because I want to make sure that if you accidentally say something different and it gets a laugh, you have to go back and listen to why. Yeah. You know, it's the why. And I remember, like, I go around, I carry my notebook, and it's like I love writing jokes down first, you know. And
so you're
like,
fully writing it down. You're like,
I fully write it down, and I'm like verbatim. I write them all. Like I sit down and I'm very specific. And that's how I started doing it, you know. Soon after the resume joke, I started thinking, like, what is it about my family? Like, let's talk about what I did growing up, or let's talk about something. And then one day I started thinking, it hit me that I was the person, as the youngest, that had to taste the milk to see if it was expired. Right? And I started thinking, I know I'm not the only one that had to go through this, you know? And it's that thing where I hated it. It was that thing where everybody, like, my mom would stand next to me, like, is it good? Like, you know what I mean? And you hated having that job. But once I wrote it down as a joke and I did it, I realized so many people were in that bubble. They resonated with it. They clicked. And that's when I realized you can talk about anything in your life because you're always going to find people that connect with it. But that's the thing, though. I think it takes years. I think it takes a while to understand and learn that. That in stand-up, people try to be funny and they try to create and make things that are contrived that they think people will laugh at.
Yeah.
But if you write something that's true to you, you'll find your audience.
Yeah. There's a clip. I found a few versions of the joke, and there's one where you do it on Legally Brown, which it seemed like it was, I don't know where it aired, but it was a special that you did.
Showtime.
So, and you're telling this joke, and it's wonderful that the camera people got it, because they're shooting from the audience perspective, and there's just, seemingly this is what the visual narrative is, that someone is holding the hand of a person next to them and pointing as if being like, this is my sister.
Or,
and they did it. And I was amazed, because usually, like, it's a shot that almost never bears fruit in that way. And it truly, like, the entire joke is told from the, like, as if they want to be like, do you see that? Like, it's amazing, because you think this is like, well, no one's doing this. And also, like, you heighten it to a point, but it's like, something about when you're doing it, it's like it's a wonderful version of it, because they're so, and I think it gets exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, well, and that's the thing, right? I think especially, you know, one thing I've learned in doing stand-up, especially from like my perspective, because here's the thing, I never wanted a TV show. I never thought I was going to get one. I mean, look, at that time, I had a crooked tooth. I was considered chubby for Hollywood. You know, I wasn't like the hot sex pot. Like I always say that with Latinas, you know, for a long time in Hollywood, in your 20s, you're like the sex pot. And then somehow 30s through 50s, you have to go away. And then you come back as the wise grandmother. You know what I mean? So like, I never thought that I would ever have a TV show. I never tried. It was actually, they approached me because of my set.
Yeah.
Because I was talking about my family, because I had so many stories. But that was accidental. That wasn't something that I ever tried to do. And it was that thing where, you know, for me, it's kind of what I was saying at the beginning. When we started, there were so many comics that would say, you stole my idea. You did this. You did that. And I quickly thought, well, you can't steal my life. You know, so let's write about my life. Like, can never accuse me of stealing something if it's my life.
Yeah. You if know? It's a thing that happened to you, you can be like, this is the time it happened to me. So unless
exactly.
You are also me, I didn't take it from you.
Exactly. You know, it's like, years ago, someone sent me a video of a comic, I think in Atlanta, that was doing the resume joke. They were like they sent it to me. And immediately I was so upset. And then I thought, at that point, my joke had been everywhere. And I'm keep doing it, dude. Like, you know what I mean? You keep doing it. Like, you're not a cover band. Someone will call you out soon. And it, like, I never heard of the comic again.
That's funny. You're like, what's going to happen? It's not like this person's going to get more famous than me from my joke. Eventually, it's like the internet exists. Someone will be like,
yeah.
Also, like, a known joke. So I want to go through each part of it, because I want, especially since you talk about being interested how it evolves, I'd be curious to see what you remember. So the joke starts with the sort of the basic premise, which you ever rely so much on a resume, you're actually shocked they give you the job. So
are you sure about this?
Yeah. Are you sure about this? So talk about setting it up. What did you want to get across? That is a joke, but it's also a setup, which is nice. Like, you're getting a little laugh on the way to sort of the bigger stuff. What worked about that? And also, just when you're starting jokes, how do you approach the sort of first couple lines?
So, you know, really, sometimes when I, you know, look, a lot of the jokes come from just normal everyday conversation, right? Like, you talk with friends, that's why I have my notebook or something, and I'm like, oh, that's funny, and I write it down. Sometimes with that joke, for example, I literally did sit down and try to write a joke, you know, and to me, I treat it like a writing exercise.
Yeah.
You know, it really is, sometimes, you know, in order for me, I believe that in order to, you know, to kind of find your voice, you just have to use it. You have to write. Yeah. You know, and it's weird because I remember when I moved to LA, there were some comics that would make fun of me because I always had a notebook with me. And they were like, you write down everything. And I'm like, yeah, who doesn't? Like, you know, like, what? But that specific day, when I thought about the line on resumes, I literally, like, in my notebook, I write lying on resumes at the top of the page. And then I make a list of everything that I do. And I started making a list of all the jobs that I've lied on and the skills that I said I had. And then I make a list of, like, how I sometimes didn't know about it, you know? Yeah. Like, you know, like, I remember writing, it never made it into the bit, but, like, I wrote something about how, like, the first time that I heard what PowerPoint was, like, I thought I could get it at a store. Like, you know, like, I was just like, it sounds like a product. Like, I'm going to get PowerPoint. So I wrote down everything, all the jobs, everything. And that was one page. Then the next page was my sister having been my fake boss for everything and what she says. But the thing is that I started thinking, everyone in my family has kind of an accent. You know, so I'm like, well, okay, so that kind of helps. You know, like, what job would be ridiculous to kind of, like, you know, have this woman, like, do, you know? And so I kind of started writing my sister page. And then I started a chunk about what jobs would be ridiculous for my sister to have.
Yeah.
Because I know her, you know? So then I started thinking, you know, like, NASA. Like, I immediately thought NASA because I'm a big science nerd. I love NASA. So I was like, oh, man. I'm like, okay, what happens at NASA? So that like it's really kind of like a bubble chart, chart, you know. So then I'm like, okay, so what happens at NASA? And I started writing it down. Then I thought, well, a countdown. And then I was like, oh my God, my sister counts down with like the kids, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, and so, and then, you know, because my oldest nephew Sergio is special needs, I was like, he's the guy I'm gonna do, because I wanted to give a shout out to my nephew, you know. So like it was this thing where I started just kind of writing it out. And I started putting these act outs together. But because I started out in theater, I knew how to do the act outs.
Yeah.
So I started acting out like, okay, so if my sister's a character, what would she do? And I write down all the act out lines, all of them. Mm-hmm. And then
what you physically do.
Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, like what she, you know, the lines that she might say, you know, this is the thing that I think that is so important in stand up. Picking the right words, you know, in like we always say, my friends and I, we always say, instead of car, say Ford Focus. You know what I mean? It's like specific. It has, you know, like instead of bird, you say parakeet. You know, it's like it's that personalizing and making it specific somehow gets a bigger laugh, you know. So I would do these act outs where I'm like, well, what can my sister do? And it slowly started evolving to where I'm like, okay. So if she's at home and I know that she's going to go after my nephew, what is she doing?
Yeah.
So she's on the phone, you know, and I always say,
listener, she's acting it out.
Yeah. You know, so I'm like, and I'm literally like I hold the phone because, you know, it's like the phone isn't this. It's like the phone isn't like, the phone isn't like the croissant in with your hand. It's actually holding a phone, you know, so I hold the phone. And I'm literally like reading off my notebook as I do the act out. And then I start thinking, oh, well, that's kind of funny. And then I'm like, well, she's not an astronaut. So what would she do? Right. Like if she worked at NASA, she would be like, hello, is NASA. You know what I mean? Because she's, you know, and I'm like, oh, I love that. So I started, you know, I'm like, the hello is NASA. And it's kind of like, it's just, it takes so long to write it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, for me, from the initial, what can I write about? Bubble, bubble, bubble. And again, I still, like, I record every set and I still have my notebooks, all my notebooks, you know? So it's really cool to see, you know, like my first notebook, I had tabs on my notebook where it's just like different jokes. And like, it was, to me, it's just, it's a science, but it's a fun science. You know, there's something so exciting about, you know, when you see the first notebook, you see the NASA stuff. And then, you know, like 20 pages later, you see NASA again because it's evolved. And then you're just like, oh, okay, blah, 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 blah. And then later on in the notebook, you see NASA again. And like, it's so fun because then you see it and you're like, and then sometimes what I love keeping the notebooks because you go back. And the stuff that didn't work in that joke can go in something else, and there's a record of it. And that, like, it's a reminder of, hey, it didn't work at that time, or it didn't fit at that time. But guess what? Now you're in a different place of your life where you can actually write something different about that bit.
Yeah, it's amazing because hearing you talk about it, you are able to get at a place by yourself, like when you're alone writing, that a lot of comedians cannot do. They have to be on stage. Because I was thinking about how you wrote this joke, because you can see, I was like, if she wrote this on stage, I can see you writing maybe the part which gets to just, do I look at like an astronaut? People like that part. So then you're just like, oh, let me go back to the astronaut thing. And then you're like, and the countdown thing, I was like, she had to have the countdown thing near the beginning because that's like makes the most sense.
Yes.
And I found it. I found an earlier version where she goes, hello with NASA. Then you have her, you play just the yelling longer. You just go like, she's yelling at Sergio. And then I believe then you just go to the countdown. Like there isn't the astronauta part and there isn't the she goes to the moon five times this week.
Yeah.
Was that something you find on stage? Is that something where you're like, there's room for jokes here opposed to just sort of playing it as an act out?
Oh yeah. You know, like that kind of stuff. Sometimes, you know, the thing is, I think that for me as a stand up, I have to make sure that I don't get complacent with my bits, right?
Yeah.
So it's always like, am I doing too much? Do I need to do more? The joke is never finished, you know? And that's the thing. That's why for me, it takes so long for me to get an hour together. Because it's like the jokes aren't done, but is it at that point where I can feel like they're comfortable doing them? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of times where I get to a bit where I like where it's at. And then I intentionally start playing with it to see, is it too long? Is it not long enough? What am I doing? And I like seeing that because there are happy accidents where sometimes somebody will say something in the audience and I say something about the joke and I'm like, the moment I get off, I'm like, I have to remember to like clock that. I have to listen to it to write it down, you know? But that's the thing is that you have to keep playing with it and know that, you know, sometimes it's not done. Sometimes it's going to grow. Sometimes you realize I got a lot of fat in it and I got to cut it down.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Cristela Alonso.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
And we're back with Cristela Alonso. So you mentioned writing and you were like, well, what would be something my sister would say? When you're writing and or performing as your sister or any of your family members, what does it feel like? Do you feel like your background is acting and some, you know, like, do you feel like I'm her right now? What does it feel like for you to like or perform as her? Yeah.
I learned this from my mom and my grandmother. They were both devoutly Catholic, but they used to love to gossip all the time. Like, they just, like, they were such Catholic women that hated so many people. And I would learn, I think that's why I got into theater. I think, honestly, like, my mom and my grandmother would talk to each other and talk about people in the neighborhood. And they would give each one a voice, you know? And as a kid, you knew. They always use the same voice for the same person. So if you heard that voice, they're like, oh, we're talking about Roy. You know, what did Roy do? You know, so it really was accidental in that to me, the act outs were kind of like just the way that my mom and my grandmother used to talk to each other. So it's like every time that I talked to someone, and that happened in my family too, where each one of us had a voice that was assigned to us, you know, and if my mom was talking about one of my brothers, she'd be like, oh, duh, buh, 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 buh. And we knew that she was talking about my brother. So it always made us laugh, but it was always, you always knew who you were talking about. And when I was doing when I started doing bits, I started talking like my family talks.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really just assigning it. I had no idea. Even when I started doing theater, I had no idea that was a skill.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it's like there's some comedians I talk to who when they do characters, especially their family members, they're not themselves anymore. Like they're doing their mom's voice and now they're their mom for 10 seconds and they're back themselves. the example I always think of is when I asked Lil Rel. Lil Rel used to have a joke about his mother, but then after his mother passed away, he couldn't do it. It felt like he was visiting his mother when he did the joke. But what's interesting is that essentially what you're able to do is to take the character of your sister you already had on stage, off stage, on stage. It's like, it's why it feels so organic. It's almost like the private character you have that you get to bring to the audience, opposed to, oh, I'm being my sister. What is a character that would make sense that I can translate? It's like, oh, I've already done that. It allows you to both an insight on your sister, but also on how you characterize your family members.
Absolutely. You know, and it was like, again, I think that also because of my mom, she was so good at giving us each attributes. That, you know what I mean? Like, we each had our own specific traits, you know, that apparently that to us didn't exist with each other.
Yeah.
But like, my mom always saw it with us that, you know, it's so weird that I'm like, how did you come to this conclusion that this is what I do, you know? And she's like, you do it. Like, you know, like, my mom was a short woman. She was like 5'1", and my brother, my oldest brother, Ruben, I want to say he's like 5'10". And she used to make fun of him and call him like a giant. Every time she was like fed up with him, she would always say, oh, and there you are in the sky, just being dumb. Like, oh, there in the sky, in the heavens. And, you know, and my brother Ruben would play along, and he used to call her a little fire ant. And then he would look down at her and he's like, and you're down there in the little hill, like, like, then that's my family.
And again, these are two people that are like 9 inches different in height.
Completely. But it's like, so like, oh my god, like it was everything.
Yeah. You mentioned how you came up with like, oh, it'd be funny to hear her talk about space stuff and say, you know, and I wanted to ask you about, you know, the joke hinges, or there's a laugh you get from her saying chuttles instead of shuttles.
Yeah.
And I, as a person who, by having created a TV show, I'm sure has had every possible perspective on how you're supposed to represent different people, mm-hmm, thrust it upon you. When you're doing a joke that hinges on quirks of accents, like this joke, or there's a joke in your new special about your brother's accent,
mm-hmm,
how do you think about it? Is there a debate? Has it evolved?
I'll say this. What I learned from my TV show is that you'll never make everybody happy. And what I learned from doing my show is that the Latino community can be highly critical. You'll never be good enough for everybody. You know, my family grew up in South Texas. We grew up in a border town. We're like Mexican American. I'm first generation. You know, I talk about it in my special. We're a mixed status family. Some of us were undocumented, you know. So it's this thing where I can only tell you what my family would do. I can't tell you what a Cuban family could do. I'm not Cuban. I'm not Puerto Rican. You know, so it's like, I would get these complaints during my show where people would say, we're not like that. And I'm like, yeah, that's why the show's not called Every Latino in the World, is it? It's called Cristela. So for me, I always say, what's the truth? Because I always say that you can always defend the truth. You can always be protective of the truth. It's not about exploiting. It's about being honest. And, you know, for me, like with the Chuttles thing, it's like you want to make sure that you're establishing that she doesn't belong there and that it's all a lie. In that point, you're trying to picture this woman who doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know what's being asked of her, you know? So, and that's my sister, you know? But it's that thing where you can't tell me that, you know, like my oldest brother doesn't have an accent, or, you know, what have you, you know? And it really, you know, what's funny is that, like, that joke with my brother in the new special, I did Last Comic Standing, and I did that Last Comic Standing the year that Greg Giraldo was judging, and I did the resume joke. And he gave me a note and he said, you don't speak with an accent. Why does your sister speak with an accent? And I was like, oh, because my siblings all grew up in Mexico. Like, they all lived in Mexico for like a decade.
Yeah.
Before they moved to the United States. I was born here and I learned English off of TV. And this is back in like 2000 something, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, well, then write about that. Write a joke about that, you know? And, you know, and it took me so long to really write about it in a way that I felt like really conveyed what he was saying, because it took so long when, I loved Greg Giraldo, right? He was so gifted, you know? And when he said that to me about the resume joke, I started thinking, oh, but that's my truth. And then I thought, wait, but they don't know that's my truth. You know, it's like, they don't understand my family. They don't understand the family dynamic. Maybe it does seem like I'm being exploitive, you know?
Yeah.
It took like 10 years for me to really understand. That's another thing in stand-up that you have, that I learned with my writing, is that sometimes I like to over-explain at the beginning to make sure that they understand where I'm coming from, because I never want people to think that I'm ever disrespecting or not being, you know, true to whoever I'm talking about. So it's interesting that Greg Giraldo in Last Comic Standing was actually the middle of the resume joke to this new joke I have about my brother in my latest stand-up.
So that's how I learned to speak English. I would sit in front of the TV and I would just watch the shows and just repeat everything I heard, you know, like the voices, the accents. So in my family, I'm the only one that doesn't have a super thick Mexican accent, you know. My brother, my oldest brother, he was born and raised in Mexico, and he's got like that stereotypical accent, you know, like if a taco could talk. Like if Edward James almost met him, he would want to teach him calculus. You know, like, right? You need ganas. So it was always weird because we grew up together, but it always sounded like we weren't related, right? Because my brother's like, hey, sister. Nah, but you want to go get something to eat or what? I'm like, well, we could do that. Or would you like to see what's behind door number 3? Come on down. You know.
It was him. It was that note that just like immediately taught me so much, you know, and that, and again, that's one thing that I think in stand-up is so important. You don't have to listen to everybody's notes, but if you respect them and they're telling you something that they don't have to tell you, maybe listen and see if it works with what you're doing.
Yeah, it's an incredible note, because what he's doing is he's just noticing where there's information he doesn't know, right? It's a comedian's note, because he's like, I'm observing an inconsistency in this.
Yes.
And, you know, he could be calling you out on it, but mostly just sort of like, this doesn't make sense, and I'm curious about this. And what he's essentially doing is, and this is the difference between sort of like being funny and making sure you and the audience are laughing at the same thing. You're telling the audience what you want them to know about your sister, about like what you find funny about her saying these things, not what they might think for whatever reason, because these are strangers with their lives and their experiences with words, right? So like, if you just say the joke, right? Let's say you take out the beginning parts. And again, like, I'm sure you would have evolved if you did this now. The audience would be like, oh, she says that funny. Some audience, but by the more you're able to convey who you are and who they are, then you hopefully are able to, like, we're all laughing at the same things. It brings people in instead of just sort of, like, laugh at a stranger, because it's not a stranger, this is your sister. That's fascinating.
And you're right, because honestly, you get so into your jokes and you get so into the material that you forget what you're giving off. The information that you're giving. So when Giraldo told me that, it really was this thing where I was like, moving forward, I really made it a point to think about, like, am I really trying to say everything? Am I saying everything that needs to be said?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, again, it's like that line, the Chuttles line, always got a laugh, because at that point, I was playing predominantly Latino audiences. Mm-hmm. That all had a relative that they knew would say that, you know? And it was that thing where, like, it was like a shorthand, you know? So when Giraldo told me that, I was like, oh, man, it really changed. It really changed a lot of my perspective.
Yeah, it's I want to harp on this point because it really is like the note that I feel like I would give most comedians, especially early comedians, more than anything else, which is like, I don't totally know how you feel about this thing you're talking about, other than you feel like the audience will laugh at it or whatever, right? Like,
yeah.
And when it's personal, and especially when you're transitioning from, I'm just Cristela, yeah, the person who's performing in my hometown, whatever, to like, yeah, I'm on TV. How does it then, when you're like, your audience goes from, you know, five people you know to 50 strangers to 100 strangers to 10 million strangers, the onus on you is to demand more, right? It's like they are more strange than the five people that know you. And part of how you make it better is really thinking about, am I fully conveying what I want to convey about these people, especially these people I care about? That's great. I mean, so like, so you do this joke. I mean, it seems like you've had this joke for a while. It ends up being on an album that's 2014. Mm-hmm. It seems like it kept on popping up as this thing, as like this sort of like, how would I put it? As you evolved, it was there along the way and it helped you sort of guide you to where you're going. Were there other things that, you know, what did it mean to you, especially during those periods, where you're fully forming, like, what would be you as a stand-up comedian?
So here's the thing, right? So my stand-up journey has been very difficult. Look, it's difficult for everybody,
yeah,
right? So I started doing stand-up in Dallas. And in Dallas, I was one of maybe three women that were doing stand-up. And I was really, like, one of the only Latina comics. So in Dallas, I was a comic. I hung out with everybody. We would do all the open mics, you know, everything. Like, we were a community, right? Then I moved to LA, and I remember going to a comedy club, and a booker told me, oh, no, you're a Latino comic. You can't play these rooms. So you have to go and play the restaurants and bars and everything and blah, blah. And I thought, well, this is weird. Why is it different now? What's going on? And, you know, it was this thing where I was getting stuff, but it seemed like I was getting it a lot slower than a lot of the other contemporaries that I was coming up with. So I ended up getting busy on the college circuit, right? And I booked all these colleges and everything, like one of the most booked college comics of all time. And my agents at the time love money.
Sure, yeah.
So they just want to put me on the college circuit forever, right?
Yeah.
And then after a while, my agent at the time said, hey, Conan wants you to submit for a late night spot. And at this point, I had been doing stand-up for 10 years, and I couldn't get anybody to pay attention to me for a late night spot. So, you know, they're like, can you go shoot a 5-minute set? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. And I shoot the set at like Comedy Magic, my home club here in like Hermosa Beach. And I submit it. And JP Buck, who booked Conan, he comes back, has no notes for me.
Yeah.
Except one. And that's like, can you do the resume joke? Can you do the astronaut joke? And I was like, I don't do that joke anymore.
Oh, I was wondering that, because it seemed like you had done it. I was like, okay, seems like.
And I was like, I don't do that joke anymore. He's like, I love that joke. Can you do that joke? And I did it. But it's this thing, Jesse, that joke, I only do it when people ask me to do it. And it's always been someone random from the industry that's like, I love that joke. Can you do that joke? And I'm like, I guess I can do that joke. Like, you know, but it's one of those things where it's like a party favor. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I did the set on Conan, and that immediately got the attention from people. And, you know, people were saying that late night didn't do anything for comics anymore. There was like, I was getting interviewed for these articles, like two articles. Can't remember the outlets, but they were like, you know, is late night dead for like, you know, and they would compare it to like the Carson Tonight Show days and stuff. And I said, not for me. I'm doing pretty good. So that late night spot, because it was so personal, because of that resume joke, because of what I was doing, that got the attention of, like, I ended up moving agencies. I got a development deal, developed the show, everything based off that Conan set.
Yeah. It's just like it's a scene in a show. And you're like, you could see executives and be like, oh, that could be a scene, right?
Totally.
It's like, there's phones on television. Like, it is just sort of like exactly. Yes. I think like Conan, especially at that time, now, like, who knows what late night sets mean, but like.
Yeah.
When it worked, it worked. There are just sort of jokes that were a mix of perspectives that felt unique, and also and not just like stories of like, oh, we don't have a TV show about Texas
right.
Mexican family, but like literally like comedic perspectives of like, oh, we haven't, you know, I think of Pete Holmes set when he talked about magic and that white people are like, that's new. And but if we just did the set, it just did the set. But
yeah,
it's so. I remember you picked the joke. I was listening to the audio. I was like, I bet she did this on Conan. I just like, you just seems like such a good fit.
Also, understand, you know, it's like at that point, I had been doing the joke, but I had been doing it on stuff that people weren't watching.
Yeah.
So, like, it was this thing where everybody, like, when people would ask me to do the joke, it's because they knew no one had watched it previously on whatever I had shot. So it was this thing where I'm like, I had a moment where I thought, well, damn, like, I keep doing this joke. Maybe they're not watching it because of this joke. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, maybe there's a theme going on, you know?
This joke, it's interesting because it's like, it's a shortish joke, but you're like, it's fun to see this joke now because you're like, oh, like, this is the seed of how she talks about this, right? There's like, you especially in your Netflix special, you talk a lot more about class in a way that I think a lot of comedians just don't do it. I think for one, because I think, you know, it might bum audiences out to hear about class, or there's audiences like, what does she know about being poor? She's rich now just because you're a comedian. Even if you're not, even if you're just like a struggling comedian because you're on stage. So,
everybody thinks that if you're on stage, you get $10 million a night.
Yeah. But to be fair, now you are more successful. What is your impetus to talking about class? Why do you think it's important? And sort of how has your approach to it evolved as you have found more success?
You know, that was actually an evolution coming from jokes like the resume joke. And just because you realized what I started noticing, and it was like the resume joke. It was the joke that I was talking about, like expired milk. It's this thing where I never knew what was special about my life, because it's my life. You know, it wasn't until after the shows, because also leading up to the, you know, to like the pandemic, I used to do a meet and greet after every show for everyone.
Yeah.
And like these meet and greets would last longer than the show. Like I would meet people for like 2 hours after the show. I'd take a picture with everybody because I was so grateful that people came to see me. But during that meet and greet, they would tell you what they liked about your set, you know? And what I realized was that what was special about my life as seen by Hollywood wasn't special at all to me, because so many people grew up like I did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but it was this thing where the ability, the decision to talk about how I grew up, that made so many people react to it at the shows, that they're like, oh my God, you grew up just like I did. And that, because the reactions I would get were so big out of something that I never thought was very special, because it's just how you grow up, that I realized, like, we need to talk about this more. I need to talk more about, like, my life and how my life is so special as seen by some, but not special at all as seen by most. Yeah. You know, it's so it was this thing where I started talking more about like the way I lived, the specifics. And also it really was, I'm really into, you know, current events. I do a lot of advocacy work. And then I started thinking the advocacy work actually came from my stand-up.
Mm.
It wasn't until I started getting asked by people to talk, to do speeches and stuff at different organizations, that I thought, well, I'm just saying my life. This is just my life. And it just evolved into this thing where I'm like, I didn't think that a lot of comics were talking about it. And it wasn't like a decision I made to stand out or try to stand out. But it was this thing where I was like, I had no qualms about talking about it. That's one thing. As a comic, I don't care who likes me and who doesn't like me. If I get comments on the internet where they're like, you know, blah, 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 your opinion on blah, 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 and you're wrong, and I'm like, then unfollow me. Somebody else will follow me right back. Like, it doesn't matter, you know? My mom used to always say, psh, I've been hated by better people than you.
Why was your mom saying that? No, it's a great quote, but like, why was just a person?
Because my mom was actually, she for a long time was undocumented, and people would just, they would treat her so bad. And she, every time, that was like her retort, like, you know, I've been hated by better people than you. And I live by that mantra, because for me, it's about, hey, do you regret saying what you said? And, you know, again, in a time right now where people feel like they're getting called out by stuff, you know, it's like, I always say, like, do you regret what you said? There could be a chance a day where you do. And hopefully you learn better and you apologize, because that's who I am.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But for the most part, I don't say things that I'm going to regret, or that I feel like, I wonder like, oh, how are people going to take this? Because I'm at the point now where I'm like, I just don't care, because I'm being honest, and it is what it is. So for me, it is this thing where like the class talk is actually, I think, so important to have, because class surpasses any kind of ethnicity, minority, anything. It's a universal struggle, you know, and that's something I think that a lot of people, that aren't familiar with certain like minorities can easily vilify them for certain shortcomings or short problems and stuff. But we can't deny that the ultimate problem is the struggle. It's easy to blame people if you don't know them, but the struggle is the problem. And I like talking about the struggle. Because again, one thing I learned in my career so far, I'm pretty much the anti every stereotype or assumption that people have from someone that grew up like me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the daughter of undocumented parents, you know, we grew up on food stamps. Oh, how dare you use government assistance, da 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 da, you know. But then as an adult, I give back all the time. I love to give back to the country that gave me so much, that gave me the chance to survive, you know. And it's that thing where that's one of the reasons I like to be so vocal too, because I'm like, we're not all like the way that you assume we're all like, you know. And it always goes back to money and to struggle and to class.
In passing in one interview, someone asked if you'd ever run for office. You said yes. And I was not expecting you, that you were like, well, after I achieve certain goals, maybe I'd run for Congress around where I grew up.
Yes.
And one, I want you to talk about that. But also, I can't even think of how to question. Like, most comedians, they're just like, oh, yeah, I'm talking about this stuff. And I like talking about this stuff. And I'm able to talk about this stuff. But I would never, like, do whatever that means. Like, I would never actually, like, do the politics.
Right.
How's it all intertwined for you?
You know, to me, one thing that I think is very important to me is really trying. I know this might sound grandiose, and I don't mean it to be, but I don't know how else to say it. I really believe in serving the people.
Mm.
And I think that it comes from doing stand-up and really seeing people that are affected. You know, and it's this thing where if you can do something, why not do it? You know, and because of the circumstances that my family grew up on, because they were so extreme, I have sympathy for everybody that has had the similar struggle or is going through it right now. You know, so for me, like DACA. Right. DACA, for those of you that don't know, DACA is a program undocumented Americans, as I call them, that were born within a certain number of years. They can apply to basically have a permit to be able to work and go to school here in the United States. I became a very big supporter of it because after my shows, people would tell me that they were undocumented and they would tell me that they were on DACA. Now, to apply for DACA, whether you get approved or not, it's a $495 application. That's a lot of money for people that don't have the money. So sometimes I started meeting them. I just decided to do free shows where I raised money and gave all the money to DACA recipients because the money for these shows didn't mean anything to me. Like I could, meaning that I could survive without them, but it could change people. Mm. It could change people's trajectory for a while. So why not do that? That kind of thinking, and that again comes from my family. It's this idea that like, if you don't have a lot, but you can give something, please give it. Mm. And I love working in like the advocacy world. And I love being like, I love being in politics and trying to understand and try to teach people that change takes a long time. And we can't be so cynical all the time, even though we try to be cynical. And I know it's easy to be cynical. We also have to celebrate that one time that that 1% change happens, because change is like losing weight. You know, it takes a long time to lose the weight that you gained, you know? Yeah. And for me, I started thinking about what I could do. And I always told myself, running for office, if it was something that I felt I could help with, if it was something that the community thought that I could do, that I could help with, then why not do it?
Yeah. You mentioned social anxiety, and you talk about that more the special than in the past. And it's interesting doing research on you in order, right? You in the past, you'd be like, I started doing stand-up because I couldn't afford therapy after my mom died. And now you can't afford therapy, and you do talk about going to it. So you don't need stand-up to fulfill that role. And I imagine stand-up failed in its ability to just be therapy. So can you talk about that evolution of a little bit about what stand-up was, but more about once you realized if stand-up isn't going to be my therapy, what am I using it for and what can I use it for, especially as it relates to talking about the things that, you know, that are involved in that?
Well, to me, actually, stand-up did actually work out as a form of therapy. You know, well, for me, it was just, you know what it was, is that going through such a big loss with my mother, who was like the most important person in my life ever. Like, I talked about my family and I talked about her, but it was hard. It was really hard. Like, the first special I had, Lower Classy, the last joke, I shot it in, 2016? That joke happened, all of that happened in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Took me 13 years to actually get to that joke, you know? But stand-up helped therapeutically because it allowed me to talk about my mom and have people laugh at it and to laugh at her. And it really made me appreciate the moments I had with her a little different, you know, because I felt like it was still connected. And again, the audience would tell me, oh, my mom is just like that. My grandmother's just like that. And it was just kind of like, it was a nice sympathy and connection that I think I didn't think I was going to get.
Yeah.
Thing is, though, is that therapy is expensive, right? And in 2008, I went to therapy. I was very depressed. And I didn't know I was depressed. But I was seeing a therapist that was seeing me on a sliding scale. And I was so broke. But the last session I could afford was the session that she told me that I suffered from depression. And I couldn't go back to discover why. So that was 2008. Then I got the show in 2014. And I got health insurance. And I didn't know what to do with the insurance. Like, I didn't know how it worked. Nothing. Like, it was just kind of like this whole new ball game. And my show got canceled in 2015. 2016, I don't want to spoil it, but things happened in this country that really affected me. I fell into a deep depression. And my friend Steve was the one that helped me decide that I needed to go to therapy. And it was this thing where I thought, I really forgot about therapy.
Yeah.
At that point. And then I had this moment where I'm like, wait a minute, I can afford therapy. And I went to a therapist, then I went to a psychiatrist. I got diagnosed with like social anxiety and severe depression. And it was weird because I never shunned it. Mm. I never thought that, you know, I never thought anything negative about it. I just didn't have access to it. And once I had access to it, changed my life. Like, changed my life so much that the first thing I thought, I was so angry at how I had to get a TV show on the air to have money to take care of my mental health. You know, and how that is just a sign of what the problems are in this country. You know, that it's just like,
you had to get a TV show.
I had to win the lottery to go and like get medication and get help for something that changed my life in such an insanely like wild way that I, 10 years ago, 6 years ago, I could never have imagined feeling the way that I do now. And that's why, and I know, like, going through that, I think about it and I think, how many people out there don't struggle with that? How many people don't have that, you know, that experience? And for me, being on that side where I am taking care of myself, it makes me think, I want other people to know that they can. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, and that's when I start thinking, well, how can they take care of themselves, right? So then you start thinking, there's so many people that don't even know that there's outlets, there's programs available, because some people are so poor, they don't have the internet. So we need to talk about that. So it's like this domino effect of all of this stuff that happens to me personally that I'm like, I have to talk about this because... Yeah. I don't want anybody else to talk about it. If I want to talk about it, why don't I talk about it?
Yes. You know, you dedicate a lot of your work to your mother. The special is, I like looking at the dedications of specials because some comedians don't do it. And you're like, this is dedicated to your mother. You talk about how the show was. And when thinking about you, I was thinking about the idea of dreams, both aspirations and the American dream, and how your mother, when you first told her that you wanted to pursue these things, she was sort of against it and she pushed back upon it. And it seemingly had a very hard time with the idea of you pursuing your dreams. And so now, you know, it's like about 15 years later, of you starting stand up or so, right? It's about mm-hmm. 15 years. How do you think about your success as relates to that? Are you able to think about what she would think about your success? You know, like that's the thing of like when I'm reading your book or just thinking, it's like that's the answer to a question that I as a listener was like really trying to figure out. How do you think about it?
You know, it's hard. My mom couldn't understand what I was trying to do. But you know, it's funny. My mom wanted to be a singer. She grew up in a village in Mexico with like no electricity, no running water, nothing. So like so extremely poor. Like we grew up squatting in an abandoned diner and my mom's like, oh, we're moving up. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's my mom, right? Yeah. So like her family mocked her and like made fun of her and said, what are you doing, stupid? You can't sing. Like we can't even eat, you know? So it's this thing where I think that a lot of times that idea stuck in her head. It's like, hey, you're poor, and if you're poor, you can't do all this stuff. So when I told her that, again, she's like, we're poor. Like, mm-hmm. what are you doing? Like, You know, that's why I always say, and maybe you saw this, but I use this all the time. My mom used to always tell me, you got to cut hair because even in a recession, people's hair grows. My mom didn't want me dating, but if we ever went out and she saw a guy in a suit, she's like, he's successful. And then I'm like, or a defendant, like, it could be so many options, Mom. But my mom accepted that I wanted to do something different. I will say that some of my family referred to me as a black sheep. You know, there were times where, like, I think my sister told her kids once, like, don't be like Cristela. Like, don't do it. You know, like I was out doing like hardcore drugs and just going on benders, you know, it's like, I want to perform, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so I think in the most sincerest way, I don't think my mom would have understood it, but I think she would have been so happy that I was happy. And that's, like, such a big thing. Yeah. I think that, like, she would have been so happy that her daughter was happy doing what she wanted to do. Because that's a big luxury in my family.
One of the things I always think about you doing stand-up is that you smile. A lot of comedians don't smile. I don't know who told comedians not to smile, but somewhere along the way, they're like, you should look like you're not having fun. I mean, I know what it's like. I can see how it started, but it is a thing of, like, beyond even done. Like, there's one thing where, like, comedians aren't supposed to laugh at their jokes, and I do think comedians do that more, but smiling is still. So we've talked about a little bit the sort of, like, there's the joy of your stand-up. There's sort of like a childlike wonder. Even when you're thinking about writing this joke, it is like so much, there's like a playfulness to even you and yourself. Where does that come from? How do you maintain that even when you're talking about things that are sort of darker? Why is that important for you? Why is it a sort of a guiding principle for you?
You know, it's funny. After the Conan set, there were so many people that said that I had like one of the best sets on Conan, like ever in a long time. It was like, and I always told them the same thing. I was very happy to be there. It had taken me 10 years to get a late night spot. And I know that for some, it takes a long time, you know, longer, or they don't get it. I was very happy to be there. And I remember thinking, I'm behind the curtain, about to go up on stage. And I keep thinking, I want this audience to know how happy I am. Like, this is such a big deal for me. And the curtains open, and I come out, and I'm so excited. And they're right there with me because I'm so excited. I really get so excited that I get to do this for a living. Mm-hmm. Aside, you know, like Leno, Jay Leno and I talk about how we both love stand-up so much that anything else that we do is, you know, it's fun, it's cool, whatever, but it's always about stand-up. The fact that I can do it, I can't help but smile. But also, I do use it as a trick at times,
sure,
because you can't preach to people and you can't come off condescending if you're trying to teach people awkward truths that they don't want to hear. But when you smile, man, it's easier for them to learn. Like, you know, like, I can do a joke about, like, what is it, from my first special, like, the good old days. Well, when were they, right? Like, when were these good old days? Like, if they were so good, why don't you really see a lot of black people doing Civil War reenactments, right? Like, you know what I mean? It's like, you talk about historical facts, but you do it with a smile.
Yeah, yeah.
And man, it's certainly easier for people to, like, laugh when you're smiling. And then afterwards, they're like, what the hell did she just say? Like, you know what I mean? So it is a little bit of, you know, it's a little bit of both.
So now it's time for our final segment. It's called the Laughing Round. It's like a lightning round, but because this is a comedy podcast, I call it the Laughing Round.
Love it.
Is there a joke you wish you could steal? A comedian's joke that you saw that you're like, I wish I had that. I wish this was another dimension where everything was exactly the same, but that joke was now something that I could tell and no one would be the wiser.
Patrice O'Neill, elephant in the room.
The whole thing?
The first part where he talks about how like they don't go looking for black people when they're missing. That whole chunk, it's like the first 7 minutes or so. It's like genius. Genius. It's just because had me dying and so much truth that they're like, you know, like, I think towards the end he talks about how like if you go out into the ocean, like you got to have like a little white baby attached to you so that if you go missing, they go find you. It's so brilliant because it's so true. It was so, it's so true. Like I die every time I have that special. I see that special so much because it's one of my favorite specials. Mm-hmm. And I love that bit, still kills me.
It's a great choice. Comedians have a hard time laughing. Most comedians do. Comedians famously laugh by saying that's funny.
Yeah.
What was the last time comedy made you laugh?
Oh, all the time. You know, I have to say, you know, man, a lot. Last special that I saw in its entirety was Wanda Sykes' latest one. Mm. And that Wanda's hilarious. Like, I'm the person, I laugh. I just can't help but laugh. Yeah. I'm a big laugher. You know what I mean? So comedy makes me laugh all the time. If I say something's funny, then I probably don't think it's funny.
Do you have a short story of an interaction with a legendary comedian, living or dead, that you'd like to share with us or you feel comfortable sharing with us?
Sure.
Or if it's gossipy and bad, you can tell the story without saying who it's about. That's the new disclaimer.
Oh, I love that disclaimer because somebody, you know, somebody did it.
So often the first story people have is bad. And I'm like, oh, well, that's the story we want to hear. But it helps me a nice story about a person you want to admit.
Let me see. I'm trying to think. Man, these questions are so good.
Oh, thank you.
They're so good. Let's see. You know, here's a short story. And it was actually, and it's actually about Jay Leno. Because I hated that I couldn't do, look, I was a kid when Johnny Carson retired, right?
Yeah.
And for years, I wanted to be on The Tonight Show, and I couldn't get on The Tonight Show. And I remember I was doing Comedy Magic, Hermosa Beach. The owner asks if I want to open for Leno. And it's the first, I've never met him. And I'm like, sure, I'll do it. And I go, and we talk, and he sees my set, and he asks me, how come you never did The Tonight Show? And I was like, I don't know. You tell me. And it was like this thing, like, because I had that as like a chip for so long because I'm like, I want The Tonight Show. Because that was like the iconic show.
Yeah.
Look, it's either that or Letterman, right? Yeah. And I ended up doing panel on Letterman, like on one of his last shows. So I was like, closest I'm going to get. Yeah. Love it. Letterman kissed my hand. I have a picture of like Letterman kissing my hand. I'm like, I'm done. And he was like, we should have had you on. And that we should have had you on, that, like, if I could put that on my tombstone, we should have had you on The Tonight Show. It was like such a redemption. You know, like when you like maybe break up with someone or something like that, and then like you end up Googling them, like Facebooking them, like decades later, you're like, I'm doing better than them. That's how it felt.
Perfect. Do you have advice for an aspiring comedy maker of any sort?
Be true to yourself and don't let anybody tell you that you can't do it. And also know that a lifelong dream takes a lifetime. It's, you never get to the end of it. Every, all parts of it, the failures, the successes, it's all part of the dream. So don't try to do it unless you know that you're not doing it for money or fame. Because if you're doing that, it's so vague that you don't know how much money is enough, how much fame is enough. You got to do it because you really love it. And trust your gut. You want to do it for a reason. So if you think it's funny, it's funny.
I wrote down lifelong dream takes a lifetime. I've never heard that before. That's really good. this is the last one. Do you have a joke that you wrote you thought was so funny, you maybe performed it a couple times or something, and it never works, but you will go to your grave being like, I was right, they were wrong, this is hilarious?
Oh, man! I'm trying to think. Usually I just bury them. I hold funerals for all of them. Oh, man. It was a joke. Man, I'm going to bring it back. I think it's a joke about how how as a country we're nicer to aliens from outer space instead of other people. Like, we welcome all, like, E.T., we're just like, oh, my God, everybody, he's adorable. Juan, get out of my face.
You know what I mean? That's really good.
I think that at the time when I was trying to do it, because this was years ago, I don't think we were ready. But you know what? Now I'm going to bring it back.
That's so good. It's just like, of course. I can't believe. Yes. Anyway. Great. I'm happy that this was a reminder to do that joke.
I love it. You know, I love it. Thank you, actually, because I wouldn't have thought about it otherwise.
Perfect. This has been, thank you so much. It's been so great. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch Lower Classy and Middle Classy on Netflix. You can buy or stream some of the hits wherever you get music. Follow Cristela on social media at Cristela9. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, and Camila Salazar. Gadma Shrikishin did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next Thursday. Have a good one.
Welcome to Good One. Show about talking them jokes. Son. Hey, Good One. It's a good one.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.